This evening, Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23 is where we'll be this evening. I just heard the AC turn off. For some of you, you're like, praise God. And others of you are like, please stay on. It's funny, in a church service, I can look and I see some people like me, they're fanning themselves, and I see other people freezing, and it's the same auditorium. And it just shows how we're all different, all different. Some of you are like, you know, Pastor, we could really save the Lord's money if we didn't use that air conditioning as much. And others of you are like, Preacher, that's why we tithe. We tithe for air conditioning, and I don't know why we don't use it, but anyhow. Luke chapter 23, in a moment I'm going to read one verse. But before I do, I want to make a declaration if I could, and it's this. And I don't think that we look at the cross nearly as much as we should. I know that that sentiment as an evangelist, you say, well, that's easy for you as an evangelist, but you know, we sing, Jesus, keep me near the cross. Do we really mean that? I'm not saying that every message ought to be about the cross. I'm not saying that every message ought to be from the gospel accounts of the crucifixion, but you know, we ought to live there regularly. I find that the more that I look at the problems of this world and the more I look at the cross, I see the answer. Not only for lost mankind, but for Christian as well, when I see the example of the Lord Jesus. In Luke chapter 23, I want to read to you one verse tonight, and that's verse number 34. The Bible says, Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots. And tonight I want to preach to you on the subject, the forgiveness of the cross. We see one of what is commonly attributed to Christ as one of the seven last sayings on Calvary. And again, Jesus says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, dying words are very, very important words. I think we understand that from a human perspective. Several years ago, I had an uncle who passed away. He was an uncle that held a special place in my heart. It was my dad's brother. The night that my dad passed away when I was 15 years old, it was this uncle that came to my house that night, took me and my mom and took us to his house. We spent the night there so that we didn't have to be alone at home. And almost every birthday, every holiday, my uncle would think of me and remember with me when something many people didn't. His real name was Louie, but his nickname was Pee-wee. The reason his nickname was Pee-wee was twofold. Number one, he was a short fella. Number two, he was a junior. His dad, my grandpa, his name was Louie. And so Pee-wee, his name was Louie, and they nicknamed him Pee-wee. But I remember my aunt called me several years ago now, and she said, Alton, she said, you need to make the trip up here. She said, your Uncle Pee-wee has been diagnosed with liver cancer, and we don't know how bad it is, but we suspect that he only has a short time. And so I happened to look at my calendar, and I had one of the following Sundays open, and I said, I'm going to tell you what, Aunt June. I said, I'm going to make my way up there on such and such a date. And so after the church service, I drove up there and I saw my aunt. I remember walking up through the garage into the carport area and into the kitchen, and I met her and I made a left into the living room. And when I went into the living room, I wasn't prepared for what I was about to see. I saw my uncle. He was sitting in a chair and he was staring just pretty much with a blank expression at the wall, and he was a shell of the man that he used to be. His skin was heavily jaundiced. His eyes were very glassy. And I sat down and I began to talk with him. And It was really one of those awkward one-sided conversations. I would tell him things, ask him things with no response. And so I continued to do that for several minutes, really just not knowing what to do. And after a while, my uncle broke out of a gaze and he looked at me and he said, "Now, Alton," he said, "I want you to preach my funeral." Now, I just want to let all of you know that's one of those things when you ask a preacher to preach his funeral, it's not like we're jumping at the chance to do it. And I looked at him and I said, "Well, Uncle Pee-wee," I said, "if you live to be 100, it won't hurt my feelings. But," I said, "if that's what you want me to do, it'd be an honor to do it." And when he asked me to do that, my heart flashed back to several years prior. For the majority of my uncle's life, he lived it on his own terms. And he lived it his own way, doing his own thing and not giving God any time, any attention. But several years prior, at a Christmas holiday function, my uncle pulled me into the kitchen and he put his arm on my shoulder and he said, "Now, Alton," he said, "I want to tell you something." He said, "I want you to know I've gotten saved and I've settled things with God." And it was truly remarkable in the last years of his life how that Christ had so changed him. He was never a horrible man, but now in the latter part of his life, he trusted Christ, received God's forgiveness, and I'm telling you, God transformed his life. And I want you to know, when I preached his funeral, that meeting gave me great comfort. And so after that visit that day, I didn't realize this, that that'd be the last time that I would see my uncle alive. It was just a few days later that my cousin called me up. And this was a cousin that I fought with like cats and dogs. He was left-handed, I was right-handed. I still remember the fist fights that we would get into when we were kids, rough and tumble. And I would punch him with my right hand and he would punch me with his left. And then when it was all said and done, we would sit and laugh about it. But at the time, it felt like World War III. And I'm going to tell you, this cousin who's a man's man, it's the first and only time I've ever heard him cry in my life. He called me, and the only words he could utter out of his mouth were these words, "He's gone." And so I told my cousin, I said, "Listen," I said, "I'll be up there, and I'll get up there right away." And I did, and I sat with the family, and my cousin pulled me aside, and he said, "Alton, you won't believe what happened earlier today." He said, It was amazing. His dad had been in a non-communicative state for a couple of days or so. And on that particular morning, he awoke with a clarity. And that morning, he called his family into the bedroom. He called his wife, his two children, and my cousin's fiance all into the bedroom. And my cousin said, "Dad spoke to us with such clarity and such heart and such meaning." He said, "I'll never forget it." He looked at my mom and he told my mom how much he loved her and how much he was thankful for her. And he was glad that he could spend his life with her. He said he looked at my sister and myself and told us how much he was glad that we were his children and that he loved us. And he said, "Alton," he even looked at my fiance and said, "Now listen, I know you're getting married in 2.5 weeks, and I'm sorry I'm not going to be there. But I'm sure you'll be the best daughter-in-law a man could ever have." He said shortly after that, he closed his eyes and he passed away about 30 minutes later. And you know, those last words, that family will never, ever forget. And they believe those words to have great importance. Well, do you realize, ladies and gentlemen, in the text that I've read tonight, we have read the words of a dying man. Just by virtue that they come from the lips of a dying man, we ought to pay careful attention, but even much more so because these words come from the lips of Jesus. And it's in His dying breaths that He teaches us the importance of forgiveness. And as we go through the message tonight, I want you to see a twofold thing. I want you to see that, first of all, forgiveness is a wonderful thing to receive. Every person in this room was born needing God's forgiveness. I remember years ago hearing a famous public figure say in a television interview, he said, "I don't need forgiveness. That man's mistaken regardless of how much money he has." But forgiveness is not only a wonderful thing to receive. Forgiveness is a wonderful thing to give. And we like to receive it more than we give it. And tonight I want to speak to you about the forgiveness of the cross. And I believe with all of my heart that it's this matter that in some lives hinders spiritual growth. That it's this matter that hinders the cause of revival. It is this matter that we sometimes see people enslaved for years because they refuse to forgive. Remember, forgiveness is a wonderful thing to receive, but it's a wonderful thing to give. And if I could restate it another simple way, it's impossible to be like Jesus unless you're willing to forgive. Now, with those things in mind, I want to fasten your attention on the words of Christ when He says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And I want to ask you tonight, do you have a heart of forgiveness? The first thing that I want you to see this evening is I want you to see the background of this cry. I think it's very important for you and for me to realize what happened to Jesus before this point. While these words in and of themselves are very powerful, "Father, forgive them," we say that's a virtuous thing. When you consider what happened to Jesus before He utters those words, listen to me, those words are all the more powerful. You say, well, what happened to Jesus? Well, Jesus experienced several things, one of which was this. He experienced the disloyalty of His disciples. Do you remember Jesus calls 12 to His side? One is going to ultimately betray Him. But when He is delivered to be crucified, the Bible tells us that everyone forsakes Him. But I want you to recount with me how He is delivered to be crucified. Do you remember the Bible tells us that Judas betrayed Him with a kiss? In Luke 22, verse 47, "And while He yet spake, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near unto Jesus to kiss Him." This kiss was a sign to the people that this man was to be arrested, this man was Jesus, and this was the man to be crucified. We find in other passages that the price for Jesus' head was 30 pieces of silver that Judas received, and he betrayed the Son of God. Folks, I think I would much rather experience betrayal with a fist or the back of a hand than betrayal with a kiss. A token of affection that was insincere. Jesus experienced the betrayal of Judas. But not only that, Jesus and the disloyalty of His disciples, it was not only Judas that betrayed Him, but the Scriptures tell us that all of them forsook Him. In Mark 14, verse 50, it says, "And they all forsook Him and fled." You want to talk about being isolated? You want to talk about being left at the time, humanly speaking? You would say you need the most support. Some of these men had forsaken great things. All of them had forsaken something to follow Jesus. And now every last one of them sells Him down the river. But there's one disciple that stands out above the others. His name is Peter. Some of you in this room say, "I identify with Peter. I speak sometimes before I think." Some of you say, "I identify with Peter because I'm very quick to declare what is on my heart and what is in my mind." Well, Peter, he declares that he is not going to forsake the Lord. And yet the Bible tells us in Mark 14, verses 69 through 71, that Peter is going to deny Jesus even to the extent that he is going to curse and to swear, saying this, "I know not this man of whom ye speak." Jesus experienced the painful disloyalty of his disciples, but listen to me, when he's hanging on the cross, despised and rejected of men, I want you to hear what he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Not only does he experience the disloyalty of the disciples, but Jesus also experiences the hatred of the religious leaders. The Bible says he came into his own, and his own received him not. Listen, there's a part of every one of us that cringes at the idea of rejection. Teenagers want to be rejected by their peers. And even within all of us here tonight, there's something inside of us that despises the idea of being rejected. We want to be accepted, but Jesus was rejected by his own. And he experienced the hatred of the religious leaders. How much so that those religious leaders lied about him. Jesus was put in a kangaroo court between Herod and Pilate. He's being bounced back and forth. He's a political time bomb that people really don't want to deal with. They're trying to pass him back and forth, hoping that the other person will take care of him. And the religious leaders during this time, they're conspiring together, and they solicit people to tell outfaced lies, to lie, bear false witness against Jesus. These same religious leaders would be a part of a movement where they would mock and they would humiliate. "If thou be the Son of God, then come down." So you find that not only did he experience the disloyalty to the disciples, but he experienced the hatred of the religious leaders. And can I tell you, it was religion that nailed him to the cross. Those that should have welcomed him, instead, they're the ones to despise him. And yet, in spite of all of that hatred of religious leaders, instead of calling down legions of angels to destroy the world, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." But there is one other thing that Jesus experienced before he said, "Father, forgive them." You say, what is that? Not only did he experience the disloyalty of the disciples and the hatred of the religious leaders, but he experienced the cowardice and the brutality of the Romans. Being passed back and forth, Pilate desperately trying to get out of a situation, and when it comes time to release a criminal to the people, they cry for Barabbas rather than Jesus. And in his last ditch effort, he lets Barabbas go. Why? Because he's willing to content the people. And then Jesus is subjected to the most awful type of brutality known to man during that time, Roman crucifixion. Jesus was subjected to physical pain, nails in his hands and in his feet. He was subjected to humiliation, a crown of thorns and mockery, even before he was nailed to the cross. And ladies and gentlemen, do you realize the humiliation as the Son of God is hanging on the cross being crucified? Can I tell you, modern art, when I say modern art, it's probably art from the last 500 years. Do you know that their depictions of the cross are very sanitized compared to what it actually was? I don't believe that Jesus had the convenience of a loincloth, and I don't even believe that Jesus could even be recognized as a human being as he hung on the cross based on what Isaiah 52 tells us at the end of that chapter. He was beaten, I believe, not only beyond recognition as who is that, but I believe it was as beyond the recognition of is that even a human being. And the whole time Jesus is hanging on the cross, or at least for a substantial portion of it, His mother's at the foot of it weeping until there are no more tears. Folks, what I've done in the last 3 to 4 minutes, it doesn't even scratch a surface to the brutality and the embarrassment and the heinous hatred that came out that day at the cross. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Have you ever experienced disloyalty? People that you had invested in, and all of a sudden you're turned upside down? Have you ever experienced lies being told about you, hateful things? Have you ever experienced pain physically at the hand of somebody else, or emotional at the hands of someone else? Listen, all of us in this room, if you've lived any amount of time, you've experienced that in some form or fashion. What am I saying? Jesus knows exactly how you feel. And Jesus set the example when He said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Instead of having a heart of vengeance, Jesus had a heart of compassion. Vengeance will destroy a person, but being like Jesus can only help you. But not only do you see the background of this cry of forgiveness, but the second thing that I want you to see is I want you to see the timing of this cry of forgiveness. When does this cry happen? It happens as Jesus is on the cross. And in verse 34, the very first word gives us a sequential hint. It says, "Then said Jesus." And I think in that word of sequence, "Then said Jesus," all of these things have happened. Now all of the brutality is coming to a culmination. And it is at that point Jesus makes His declaration, and it says, "Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them." You know, I have met people that have let things, let me rephrase that, I've met Christians who have let things eat at them for years. I've talked to children who've had resentment towards parents. I've talked to parents who've had resentment towards children. I've talked to full-blown adults who experienced a grave hurt and they allowed it to control them for years. I remember preaching in a place one time along these lines, and there was a gentleman, he was an elderly gentleman, and he saw me at the front of the auditorium, and that night God had convicted his heart. And after the service, he came up to me and he said, "Do you know," he said, "I've let something grip me for the last 20 years. And he was physically shaking as he was telling me the story. And he said, "I let that hold on to me. But," he said, "tonight I chose to be like Jesus." I want to encourage you. If it's a recent hurt, if it's a recent injury, if it's a recent act that has taken place, the longer you let it go, the more probability it takes root in your soul and it eventually will destroy you. You know, a lot of times a lack of forgiveness to me, it's like a little pine seedling tree. When I was in elementary school, I came home one day with a little pine seedling. A pine tree is the state tree of North Carolina, and I don't know what possessed me to do it, but they were selling these little pine trees at school for $1 a seedling. And so instead of buying a carton of milk, I bought a pine seedling. I still remember carrying it home. It was wrapped in a napkin, and the napkin was soaking wet to keep the root system wet until I could get home. And I come home marching in the door with this pine seedling, and my dad was like, "What? What are you doing with that?" And I gave him the answer that I told him on numerous occasions. I looked at him and said, "I don't know. I just thought it'd be a cool thing to buy." And he's like, "Well, now we have to plant it." I didn't really think about that. And so we went outside. I dug a hole, and I remember planting that pine tree. And it was amazing. That pine tree took off, and it grew very quickly. Within a year or two, that pine tree became my little brother, so to speak. You say, what do you mean? As an only child, you had to be creative sometimes. I can still remember throwing a football into that pine tree and tackling it. I mean, just riding it all the way down to the ground, rip the ball away, and it would just spring up with resilience. As a matter, it amazed me. Through my teenage years, that tree grew up to be quite tall. It's amazing. It survived my childhood. But you know, by the time I was graduating high school, if my mom would have looked at me and she'd said, "No, honey, I want you to go out there. You remember that pine tree you planted? You planted that in the awfulest place. I want you to go out there and I want you to get rid of that tree. And here's your little spoon. I want you to dig it out and I want you to get rid of it." Why? I looked at my mom and I just said, "With all due respect, you're crazy." And the reason why is this thing is big. The trunk is like bigger than both of my legs put together. I don't need a spoon. I need a backhoe. I need a chainsaw. I need some help here because this thing's big. And then, Mom, when I take it out, it's going to leave a hole this big and we're going to have to figure out what to fill it with. You know the difference between removing it with a spoon and removing it with a backhoe? I'll tell you what made the difference. It was time. A few years, a lot of inches of water, and nutrients from the ground, and now what could have easily been plucked out with my bad arm, my left hand, now I can't remove without great assistance. Can I tell you the same thing is true when we harbor injustice in our hearts and revenge begins to want to build? The longer we hold on to it, the harder it is to remove. I didn't say it's impossible. Folks, I can tell you, I've seen firsthand, I've seen people escape a lack of forgiveness after harboring it for many years. But I'm just saying, it makes it very difficult to do. And when you do it, it leaves a big hole where you've wasted so much. I want to ask you, is there anybody here tonight that you can think of, whether it's in this church or whether it's in your family, in your neighborhood, somebody that's crossed your path in life? I want to ask you, has something been harboring in your heart even in a very low-key fashion, and tonight you realize, tonight I need to be like Jesus? When it says, "Then said Jesus, Father, forgive." I love that word, forgive. Boy, that is a wonderful, wonderful word. It's a beautiful word. In Acts 4, verse 32, the Bible says, "And be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another." But here's the catch. "Even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you." It's interesting. Paul's addressing Christians, but in the process of addressing Christians, he points back and he says, "Remember what happened to you?" I'm not interested in stirring up your past. The devil does a great job of that, doesn't he? He's an accuser of the brethren. But you know what? I do think there's some merit every once in a while just to look up in the rearview mirror of life just long enough to realize that all that bad back there, listen, God through the blood of Christ forgave me, and that ought to motivate me to forgive others. Aren't you glad God doesn't hold grudges? He could look at every one of us and say, "You know what? I gave my son for you and you blew it. You just kept spitting in my face, so that's it." It may be that some of us here this evening, maybe the best thing we can do is take a few moments and remember when we were forgiven. And before you march out of this room tonight, content in your heart to have anger and hatred, or maybe for somebody, you're just here on the fence. I mean, you know, we all struggle. We all battle. I don't fault a man for struggling, but I'll fault him for falling down on the wrong side of the fence, because ultimately that's going to be his choice. But there are times God grips us and says, all right, listen, this is what I want you to do, and we have to make up our minds to do right. And you find yourself on the fence. Before you leave, just remember what God did for you and be motivated to do that for others. But you know, forgiveness is something, sometimes it's easier said than done, isn't it? I know you folks think you preachers are pie in the sky. Yeah, you tell us to do this, but I'm going to tell you what, it's hard. But you know what I found based on my own personal experience? Forgiveness becomes a little easier when I look at it from God's perspective instead of my own. One of the reasons that we have a hard time forgiving is because we see it from the point of self-righteousness, self-vindication, self-justification. We see it from our angle instead of God's. You know, I have talked to some people that were unwilling to let go of something they were unwilling to forgive. Maybe it's a child with a parent with a child, or two friends that you two people that used to be close and now they're no longer close. I've talked with some people in churches and they would look at me and they'd say, Brother Bill, listen, you have no right to tell me to forgive because you've never had anything happen to you like what happened to me. Now, what do you say when somebody gets testy with you? Have you ever met these people that were one-uppers? You know what I mean? It was like you tell something and then they one-up you. You know, well, when I was a kid, I broke my leg. And they're like, you broke one leg, I broke two. You know, when you were a kid, you said, boy, we lived in a mobile home. He was like, you lived in a mobile home, we lived in a cardboard box. You know, when somebody comes to me and they're like, Brother Bill, you've never had anything happen to you any worse than what's happened to me, I don't look at them and say, oh yeah, well I bet so. I mean, even in a crowd like this, listen, there may be people in here, you've had things happen to you that I could have never imagined happened to me. I'm not going to sit here and look at you like a Pharisee and say, well, you know, I'm sure I can one-up you. But just like I ought not look at you like a Pharisee, you ought not look at me as if you're in the position of righteousness that you have no right to be accountable to anybody because you're going to bask in what happened to you. As a matter of fact, if somebody comes to me and they say, Brother Bill, nothing's happened to me ever like it's happened to you. You have no right to tell me what to do. You know what I say to that person? I say it with love and I say it with firmness. I would look at them and I'd say, before you walk away, I just want to ask you a few questions. You don't even have to answer them. Just think about them. Here they are. When's the last time somebody nailed you to a cross? When's the last time a crown of thorns was placed on your head? When's the last time that you watched your mother cry until she had no more tears? Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is every one of us would have to hang our heads and come to this one conclusion. What's happened to me is nothing like what happened to Jesus. You know what? A lot of bad things can happen to people. I'm not here making light and saying, listen, what happened to you is no big deal. I've been in situations where people have been affected deeply by things that happened to them as children when they were taken advantage of. I've spoken to people, they had things that they would never publish to the world because they're so ashamed that they happened to them. And the truth is, they weren't responsible for it. Those things were done to them when they were innocent. And they say, I tell you, I have some things that have happened to me that have caused great hurt. I'm not saying that's not major. I'm not saying that's not big. I'm just saying when I look at the cross, it puts me in perspective. And it brings me to this conclusion, I ought to say with Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. sometimes some people come to me and maybe they won't say, well, you've never had happen to you what's happened to me, but here's their angle of attack. They say, well, I want you to know that if I forgive them, they're just going to do it again. So what use is it? Now, I'll be honest, that sort of holds water with me from a, just like purely a thinking, I'm like, well, yeah, I guess that does make sense. But I have this real bad habit. Let me tell you what my habit is. It's sometimes leaning to my own understanding. Because did you know that Jesus directly addressed that excuse? You say, uh-uh. I say, mm-hmm. In Matthew 18, Peter comes to Jesus. One day when I get to heaven, I'm going to go to Peter and I'm going to say, Peter, I want to ask you a question. Peter, do you remember when you went up to Jesus and you said, Lord, how oft shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? I want to say, Peter, I want to know, how are you feeling when you ask that question? Because when I read it 2,000 years after you said it, I just can't help but think you buttoned up your sports coat and you stuck your hand in here and you said, how oft should I forgive somebody? I mean, seven times, that's pretty good. That's pretty long suffering. I really am waiting to ask him that. But I think Jesus blew everybody away with his answer. Because Jesus saith unto him, I say not unto thee until seven times, but until 70 times seven. Some of you mathematicians are at 490. You're like, I'm going to write it down in my book. Buddy, when you hit 489, I'm going to tell you, you're about to cross a line you don't want to cross. You know, if that's you and you're stuck on the figure 490, I think you're missing the real whole point. You know what Jesus was teaching? Here it is, listen to me. Repeated forgiveness. The world looks at a person who offers repeated forgiveness and says, you're a doormat. The world looks at a person who offers repeated forgiveness and says, you have real problems. But if you're in a situation where an individual hurts you repeatedly, you've got a choice. You can either let that build up repeatedly and be like a time bomb, or you know what you can do? You can say 70 times 7. Yeah, let me tell you something about this Christian life. Sometimes the way Jesus tells me to live is not the way I feel. That's startling for some of you. I know some of you are like that. Just it's good to have. Listen, I'm glad you're here tonight visiting us from heaven if you're here. And that's you say, I've never had that problem. There have been times that I have felt one way and Jesus says another. And so I want to ask you tonight, what is it that's keeping you from having the same heart that Jesus had? Are you going to let this thing just go and kick it down the road? Or listen, tonight, will you come to peace with yourself and with God and have a heart of forgiveness? The last thing that I want you to see is what I call the blessing of forgiveness. I suppose that there's many that I could mention tonight, but I want to focus on the end of verse 34. For after Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Notice the end of the verse, and they parted his raiment and cast lots. Now here's the question that I ask you. When Jesus uttered those words, did it change the behavior of those Romans? No, it was business as usual. And if any of us in this room ever get to a point where we're like, okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll forgive, maybe I'll forgive you, and we dangle that like a little carrot, and we're like, you know, I just might forgive you if I feel like it, if you're worthy of it, blah, 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 blah. Listen, Jesus offers up this cry and nobody around, I mean, they don't change their behavior. But can I tell you, in the blessing of forgiveness, listen, there's a freedom that you gain. Bitterness is something, it's when we allow other people to control us, so to speak. They push our buttons. But do you know, when you choose to forgive, you know what? You have a clean conscience towards God. And whatever happens after that, while it may flare up again, maybe another instance takes place. But here's the great news. You don't have to live in bondage to everybody else. Jesus didn't die on the cross with hatred in his heart. And this is even after these people, they could care less what he said. I find that I think there are many Christians today that are missing that freedom. And they need to be delivered from the bondage of bitterness. I want to close with an Old Testament illustration that I think is one of the greatest instances, illustrations of forgiveness, although the word forgive is not even used in the text. And I think it's a rather unique illustration, but bear me out as I explain to you. In 2 Samuel chapter 1, we read about a funeral service. You say, they had funerals in the Old Testament? Well, I don't know that they had the funeral homes and the morticians and all of that, but people died. And when people died, they got together and they talked about the person who died. And in 2 Samuel chapter 1, do you know who dies? King Saul. And do you know who speaks at his funeral? David. Let me remind you of a little history. Jonathan brings a friend home named David, says, "Hey, Dad, meet him." And before it's over with, that is the beginning of a journey in which Saul, King Saul, tries to repeatedly kill David. Javelin throwing, army chasing. It started with him chucking a spear, and it concludes with him bringing his army through En-Gedi looking for David, trying to kill him. And now Saul is dead, and people are probably looking at each other and says, "Boy, who should we get to preach his funeral? Who should we get to say a few words about Saul?" And maybe somebody piped up and said, "Well, how about David?" Had I been in that conversation, I'd said, "How about not David?" That's the last guy you want talking. What would he get up there? "Well, I'll tell you what, the man chucked a spear at me and I was good to his son. He treated me like dirt. He was insecure and he tried to kill me. He got what was coming to him." That's what I thought would have been coming out of his mouth. I would have sat there at that funeral sermon, that funeral planning, and I would have shaken my head and said, "No." Mm-mm. But do you know what David said at Saul's funeral? Let me just give you a snippet of it. He starts by saying this. He said, "Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice." The first thing he says is, listen, don't go telling God's enemy about this because they're just going to gloat over it. You know, David was more concerned about his reputation and his sense of self-righteousness. He was concerned about God. And he said, you know what? He said, we don't want the enemies of God to rejoice. And I'll tell you, we live in a world today, and the world says you have every right to just scream to the whole world, "He got what was coming to him." I'll tell you what, that old thing called karma, that's what the world calls it, you know. They say, "I'll tell you, he got what was coming to him. He deserved it." Can I tell you, that heart is foreign to grace. And then later on in his eulogy, listen to what David says. He says, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Lovely, pleasant. You are insane. Never one time do I see the word forgive in that narrative, but I see it illustrated through and through. You know what? I'm glad you can go through life and you don't have to live being controlled by hatred and the foolish acts of others. Tonight, I want to beg you to be like Jesus. And say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.